The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey guys, welcome back to Breaking Banks. We're coming close to the end of the year. We've got a couple of very, very big shows for you guys this week. Coming up in a moment, we have Chris Larson back on the show, as you guys will call. Chris is from Ripple Labs. They're going to talk about some of the stuff they're doing, some interesting announcements come out of them. There's a lot of there's a lot of discussion over the last couple of weeks about some of the investments that are taking place in the space. We just had Australia put a dedicated innovation fund together. Obviously, a lot of fintech companies down there are looking to get in on that. One of them, Auswide, is a new Aussie bank that's put together $60 million to support a P2P lender, MoneyPlace there. They're just taking a 20% stake. So things are heating up down in Australia. Good to see, because prior to that, we've got Singapore and Hong Kong taking some activity there. Hong Kong also recently has been doing some more work on the fintech space. There's a big event coming up with Nextbank HK Invest in January, so watch out for that one to see what's happening in the fintech space. But jumping straight into the show, because we've got a lot of great guests on today. We've got Tim O'Reilly from O'Reilly Media coming up later, Robert Turchek talking about his new book, Vaporized. But before we get to that, Chris Larson from Ripple Labs, welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Thanks so much, Brett. Thanks for having us.
No, that's great. So you guys just made an announcement with Microsoft that I saw. It was very exciting. Can you tell us all about what's happening with that?
Yeah, we're really excited about Microsoft and all the great work that they're doing. They have just announced that they will be including Ripple. They will be actually a Ripple validator, using it in their Azure blockchain as a service offering for enterprise. And so, obviously, we think that fits squarely into what we think is kind of the key area with distributed financial tech, which is, we think, enterprise, and specifically around payments, and having Microsoft as a validator, and they want to be a premier validator, I think is just a great move and for validation of the space and credibility around the network we're trying to build.
Did you also see the SEC made some provision for trading on blockchain this week?
I don't know if you saw
that news.
Great stuff, yeah.
So, I wonder whether that would have helped Martin Shkreli, that guy from the pharma company that just got done for securities fraud. No, sorry, I just had to get that in. That was a bit of a joke. But so, you said Microsoft's become a Ripple validator? Was that it? Or
yeah, they're running being a validator on the network.
What does that mean for people who aren't familiar with Ripple Labs and how the network works?
The whole essence here of the distributed financial tech is that you have sort of a shared essentially database, sort of a shared state of balances, if you're using it for finance or other things like trade finance, and we'll talk about that in a moment as well. But it's really important then that you have a sort of a diverse, sort of trusted set of people running the distributed network, people can then have trust in the system without necessarily having to trust one central operator. That's really the breakthrough that's happening here, that's capturing in this notion of an internet for value. You don't need a single central operator. That means networks that were once siloed now can interoperate together, and that's how you start moving value like we've been moving information over the last 20 years. That's the real game change that's happening here. Having validators like Microsoft, of course, takes that up you know, really to obviously global institutional, you know, enterprise grade levels, and seeing more and more of that. So it's just a great development in the space.
And this is, of course, deployed on their Azure cloud and other stuff like that, right?
Yeah, exactly. This notion of sort of blockchain as a service. I mean, it has so many applications. That's just great now to see these kind of hosting services now moving in that direction. It just makes it so much easier for institutions, banks, companies, their customers to utilize this great new technology.
Now, I think there's still a lot of misunderstanding about the blockchain. You know, when you hear banks talking about this, they're talking about private blockchains. I mean, how can you have a private blockchain? The whole concept of it is a distributed system, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We don't believe in private blockchains. So I know there's been a lot of talk about that. You know, that was really, I think, meant to address the transaction privacy issues of an open blockchain. And that's a valid concern. But there's other ways to solve that. And the problem with private blockchains, to your point, is they take away the whole thing that's happening here, which is interoperability between siloed networks. And so we just don't, we need to have to step backwards. And again, there's other ways to solve that. Things like IOP, for example, is something we've introduced, the Interledger protocol. But it has to be something that's shared. And by the way, there's another key announcement happened last night around trade finance, something called TradeSafe. Coming out of Singapore, in partnership with the government of Singapore, some of the Singapore active banks in Singapore, DBS, Standard Charter.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw that.
Yeah, really exciting. And again, that has to be a distributed database. It cannot be a private blockchain for those kinds of use cases like trade finance.
Well, if you're going to do trade finance, or you're going to do identity verification, or you know, pass asset details between banks, they all need to be on the blockchain, right? So it's the classic network problem.
Yeah, for those kinds of use cases, you have to have some kind of a distributed database, and that's what they're using this for you know, the trade finance, which is using Ripple technology. Again, because it's a shared database, a shared ledger that all the parties can have access to, rather than sort of again these siloed systems, which we don't think will be the workable solution.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, so listen, I got to move on with the show, and I've got Tim O'Reilly coming up in a moment. But what's on the cards for 2016 for Ripple Labs? What's the plan?
Well, we think 2016 represents the full-on commercial production of Ripple technology and these other distributed systems, and we think specifically for payments, but also now seeing it in these other categories. So this is the year of commercial deployment. We're really excited about it.
Fantastic. Well, I hope as that starts to take place, I know you've been on the show plenty of times, but as you know, as one of the most successful companies operating in the blockchain space, you know, as this thing starts to roll out, keep us informed of your progress.
That's great, Brett. Thank you so much for having us, and happy holidays to you.
Absolutely. Thanks. That was Chris Larson, the CEO of Ripple Labs. If you want to find out more about Ripple Labs, you can obviously just find them online, and you can check out the news about their efforts working with Microsoft. It's very exciting. Up now, we have Tim O'Reilly from O'Reilly Media and Ben Lorica, I think. Is that how you say your name, Ben?
Lorica,
sorry. I should know that.
Yeah.
Ben is the chief data scientist for O'Reilly Media. Of course, Tim is extremely well known. Apart from coining the phrase Web 2.0, you know, he's been around the space of the technology space for many years. I'm not trying to make you sound old, Tim, but I do have a question for you, Tim. You know, I used to read your books on Unix and stuff when I was younger. I have to ask you this because it's been bugging me for 25 years. Why did you put those weird animals on the front covers of your Unix, you know, in a nutshell, the Windows,
you know,
XP in a nutshell?
It was a wonderful idea from a woman named Edie Friedman, who still works for us, where she basically thought that the Unix programs sounded like weird animals. You know, and if you look at some of the early books, you know, Sed and Auk, you know, there's these creatures called Slender Lorises, and, you know, or the on the cover of Learning the BI Editor. There's a little Tarsier with big eyes. Yep. And it was just an inspired insight. We were a small company. We were looking for a cheap, reusable design, and she came up with the idea of these woodcuts of animals. They're all public domain. We produced a lot of them, but that was the original insight.
Yeah, so for those that don't know Tim, well, pretty much everyone must know Tim and what he's doing, but I found one of your interesting pieces from Wikipedia is that you also wrote a well-received book on science fiction writer Frank Herbert. I didn't know you'd written a book on Frank Herbert.
I'd written some computer manuals before that was published, but that was really the thing that made me think of myself as a writer. I had a friend who asked me to do that. It's actually, Frank was a really very interesting thinker, and I would highly recommend that more people, read Dune and some of his other books with an eye to how to think about the future. And, of course, in my book, which is, of course, long out of print, but I did put it up online for free on the web, even though I don't, strictly speaking, own the rights, because it's one of these orphan works problems where the original publisher no longer exists and there's nobody to grant me back the rights. I just said, right. Well, what the heck? So if you search Tim O'Reilly, Frank Herbert, you'll find it.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. So I'll just bring Ben in here. Ben, you host the O'Reilly Data Show, which is a podcast. So this should be pretty easy stuff for you, except you're in the other seat this time around. So what's the O'Reilly Data Show on?
So the O'Reilly Data Show was an attempt for me to kind of raise the profile of people I know who are interesting in the data space. Yep. So it runs kind of the entire spectrum of, just the business managers to the people who actually build these technologies to people who invent some of the algorithms. So interestingly enough, we were quite ambitious in the beginning, and we thought, well, we should do a show on YouTube where I interview interesting people. But then we realized, of course, as you probably did too, Brett, that means getting people into a studio and being limited to people that are probably in the same area, in the same region as you. So we quickly realized podcast was the right platform. And I've been pleasantly surprised. I travel across the world for our conferences and other events, and many, many people in the data space are actually listening to this podcast.
Absolutely. Well, we're glad to have them join us. So, the joke about data scientists, right? It's what Silicon Valley calls statisticians, but
it's not actually true, because there's a lot more to data science than statistics.
Absolutely.
And all it takes is a look at a few serious companies to understand that.
Absolutely. Yeah, fair enough.
You don't build a statistics is part of building a self-driving car, but it's a relatively small part.
And we're very excited about, we had Brad Templeton on the show a few weeks ago talking about, autonomous vehicles, self-driving cars. We're very bullish and optimistic about that future. But so, Tim, this is largely a fintech show. Most of our listeners around the world are involved in the space. And I know, given that you've been involved
in
the
open source. We're eager to talk to you about go on.
No.
We're eager to talk to you about our next money summit.
We're
thinking about fintech.
So we'll start with that in a moment. But I did want to say, given that your involvement in the open source movement, government as a platform, for those that don't know, Tim popularized the phase Web 2.0, which is of course describing sort of the collective intelligence of the social movement online. So let's talk about the conference first, Tim, and then I want to ask you about, given your background, do you see any parallels in what's happening in terms of disruption of fintech, from other industries where you've seen technology disruption?
Well, actually, let's start there. I mean, that's a great place to start. I mean, because it really does have a lot to do with how we notice emerging trends.
Okay.
We're constantly trying to build a map of the future at O'Reilly, and we're looking at deep technology trends. We're thinking about what they mean. We're looking at what people who we call the alpha geeks are doing, the people who are out there on the cutting edge who really are the masters of technology and can do whatever they want. What are they interested in? And from that, we tend to find that there's a story that emerges every once in a while, you know, so whether it was open source software, the rise of the commercial internet, you know, Web 2.0, the what were the factors that were making the internet still matter after the dot-com bust, the maker movement. And so we've been actually following fintech for really about a decade. We actually ran a conference in 2007, 2008 called, oh gosh, I've forgotten the name. in New York. But my intent that time was to actually learn from the financial industry some things that would help us understand the future of the internet. And that's why we just ran it for a couple of years, because we do conferences to learn as well. And, but one of the things that I learned is also what helped me understand the current ripeness, if you like, for disruption of financial markets. One of the big things I learned, which I took back to the internet, was that at some point in the evolution of an industry, firms start trading against their customers.
Right.
You know, and what I saw was that, and actually I wrote this piece in 2007 before the 2008 financial crisis, where I said, hey, you know, let's look out, because here's the big lesson that I got from Wall Street. They started trading against their customers. Google and Facebook and the like are going to do that too. But that notion of companies saying, hey, wait, you know, we were an enabler of the marketplace, but, you know, in order to keep our growth going, we have to actually start, you know, competing with our customers, with our ecosystem, with whatever, you know, is really sets the stage for disruption. And I think, you know, even though, you know, Wall Street and banking in general got a wake-up call in 2008, I don't think we've really fixed that. There's also a deep sort of economic trend in which there's a greater and greater disjunction between what's happening for, you know, for Wall Street and what's happening for ordinary people. And so ordinary people are going, well, the economy's not working for me. And that really just opens up an opportunity for hackers and entrepreneurs to try to do it differently. And when you have an industry that's not really working for a lot of people, and you have a bunch of interested entrepreneurs and hackers who are saying, oh, well, maybe we should just route around the existing system, the conditions are ripe for disruption. And that's kind of what we're seeing right now in finance.
Yeah, I think, you know, you, obviously being a proponent of sort of the open source movement and so forth, you know, one of the great things about this is we're able to mobilize and get some of these disruptive forces up to speed quicker, right? You know, adoption's faster and there's less resistance to adoption of new technologies, things like mobile payments and P2P and things like that. So it's pretty interesting.
That's also super interesting. And again, by the way, we're kind of featuring on all of this in our next Money conference in March in San Francisco. But, you know, there's one other element which is super important, which is that we're entering this mobile revolution with money. Yeah. And one of the things that you learn from history is that the first iteration, all the existing incumbents basically replicate their old business processes, you know, using the new technology without fully realizing its potential. And then somebody comes along and says, oh, wait a minute, we don't have to do it that way. You know, so a really good example, when I first thought of this was back around the beginnings of the peer-to-peer era around 2000, when you had mp3.com, which is like, we're going to have all the songs in one place. And then Sean Fanning came along, this kid who grew up in the age of the internet, says, why do you need all the songs in one place? You know, we can just find them wherever they are, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, so that different kind of internet thinking, or, you know, think about Uber, you know, you had a connected taxi cab, but all you had in the back of it was a payment mechanism, you know, which looked just like the old payment mechanism, except it was mobile, you know, and all of a sudden it's like, no, actually, you know, we can set up payment where the act of consuming the service, you know, and tracking that consumption, you know, just automatically triggers payment. You know, I wrote a piece a few years ago about why I thought that Uber payment was more significant than Apple Pay, because, you know, increasingly, if you look at the future, we're going to be tracked. Our activities are going to be tracked. There's going to be sensors in everything. And so more and more things are going to look like the Uber payment model, where you simply consume something and they know you consumed it, and so you get debited for it. You know, versus I'm going to pull out my smartphone instead of my wallet.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I'm going to send you a blog I wrote on this very fact about Uber is the Uber of banking, because, you know, they also now are onboarding drivers with bank accounts. You know, they've removed the dispatching system. It's a whole journey that they've redesigned, basically. Listen, we just need to take a quick break, Tim. But before that, I did have a question which came over the Twitter sphere, which is, what is your favorite Frank Herbert book?
You know, it would either be Dune Messiah, the second in the Dune trilogy, people don't realize is sort of so central. It's the pivot for the whole story. And then the other one I really love is The Santa Rosa Barrier.
Okay, I haven't read that one.
A few years later, yeah.
Oh, cool. Great. Well, let's take a quick break, and then we'll ask Ben to talk about some of the stuff happening in the data space as well when we come back after the break. If you're listening in, follow the discussion on Breaking Banks on Twitter. We'll be right back after this break.
What do you want your world to look like in 2030? This is Rachel Morrissey, the producer of Breaking Banks, and we're joining the UN Global Goals Initiative and participating in Radio Everyone this week from September 25th to October 2nd. Global Goals is a 15-year plan to address 17 specific goals to end poverty, fight inequality, and fix climate change. To find out more about Global Goals and Radio Everyone, go to www.globalgoals.org.
When you're looking for the right place to eat, there's an app for that. When you need directions getting there, there's an app for that. And if you're trying to make a healthy choice, there's an app for that. But what about an app that tells you how you're doing with your money? Now, there's an app for that. It's called Moovin, a free app and debit account that automatically tracks your spending. You get real-time feedback with every purchase you make and a debit account with no overdraft or monthly fees. So if you want to stay on track with your money, download the Moovin app for free on iPhone or Android and check out Moovin.com. That's Moovin.com.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Moovin is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase, and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Moovin today.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag #BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Hey guys, welcome back to Breaking Banks. A quick shout out and thank you to our sponsor, Temenos. They're having their Temenos America's Innovation Jam on March 10th. I'm going to be there, so check that out at temenos.com. But another event that I'm going to be at, which is why we've got part of the reason why we've got Tim on the show today, is the Next Money Conference. So, Tim, tell us when is the event, and you know, what are you looking forward to?
So it's March 14th and 15th at the Palace Hotel in San Francisco. A lot of people will say, "Why are you doing a finance event in San Francisco rather than in a money center city like New York or London?" And the answer, of course, is because there are a lot of disruptive companies here. And if you want to understand, not what the existing players are doing, although we do have a number of those people very deeply involved, but understand what's coming out of left field, this is the place to come.
Absolutely. So, Ben, who are you looking forward to, you know, on the data side, you know, on sort of this, the emerging stuff? Who are you looking forward to at the next money event?
So we have a bunch of sessions on the use of algorithms, so primarily around so we're particularly keen on topics like, I don't know, Brett, you probably have covered this multiple times on your show, but kind of the robot wealth managers.
Sure, robo-advisors, yeah.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So we're particularly keen on that. We know that there are many startups that we follow that are active in this space, and that space has a huge addressable market. We're also looking at putting together an interesting panel around lending. And as you probably know, lending is one of these big success stories in fintech. And so we believe that the use of data for measuring creditworthiness is one of the most kind of disruptive ideas in this whole space. But one of the things we're also aimed to do was kind of balance out kind of the disruptors with kind of much more of the realism of the financial services market, which is, as you know, subject to regulation. So we have many, many heavy-hitting regulators on the program, including Ben Lasky, who finished his tenure as New York Superintendent of Financial Services.
Right, and bought out the bit license stuff for Bitcoin.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then, but and as you probably know, Brett, the U.S. is just one area where a lot of this innovation is happening. So we wanted to get perspectives from overseas, and one of those things we wanted to have on the program was a regulator from the UK, because the UK seems to be really pushing the envelope in terms of fintech.
Yeah, no, the London support mechanisms and infrastructure in place for fintech level 39 and Innovate Finance, we've had a bunch of them on the show from time to time. They really are very serious about it. We actually had Boris Johnson, the mayor of London, on the show earlier in the year talking about this. We asked him why London was such a great destination for fintech, and he said it's the vibe, it's the bars, it's the coders. it was fun. He's a good guy.
To that end, we're having Bob Ferguson, who leads actually the Project Innovate program of the UK Financial Conduct Authority.
Yeah.
And in keeping with our tradition, of course, of broadening even beyond technology and regulators, we're also having a bunch of who I call thinkers and scholars, including Hernando de Soto. I don't know if you've had him on your program.
Not as yet.
One of our O'Reilly's board members, Bill Janeway, who's done a lot of thinking around economics, restructuring economics, but has also been one of the driving forces behind our really getting into this whole disruption in financial services. He will also be on the program speaking with Julian Tett of the Financial Times.
Fantastic.
So, can I jump to, so you asked me earlier what some of my, you know, sessions that I'm most interested in, and I have to say one of the ones that really jumps out at me is this session called Money with Opinions with Adam Ludwin from Chain.com. It's about Bitcoin, but with a particular spin on Bitcoin, and this kind of goes back to, you know, the early technology, you know, the first implementations of technology often don't get it right. And then bit by bit, you know, people start to understand what's really different about it. And I'm really seeing that with Bitcoin. And anyway, he talks about, you know, in this Money with Opinions, it's sort of like, what can you do when you're able to embed other kinds of information directly in the money?
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, so effectively.
So we actually had a question. We actually had a question from Twitter on that, Tim, which was Jeff DeCagna from Pinnovation. He said, what are you thinking about the blockchain in terms of applications beyond Bitcoin? What do you find interesting in that space?
Well, I think in general, there's the whole sort of notion of smart contracts. I think is a big piece of it. But you know, how do you sort of establish chain of ownership on various kinds of data? I think there's a whole lot of interesting possibilities in the area of for the first time we have a technology that could potentially be used for reasonable micropayments. I've been talking to startups, for example, are looking at how would you basically be able to build a charging infrastructure for APIs. I think there's been in the past at least in theory, notions of how you could use effectively a tax to affect spam, for example. So there's a lot of interesting ways that you could, once you switch to a cryptocurrency for payment, you can actually do other things with it at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. And this is important because I think, the way we treat identity and with machine-to-machine payments and stuff like that, we are going to have a more robust ecosystem, beyond what we've got currently. And I want to talk about...
That brings in security, too. The fact is there's a lot of vulnerabilities in the current system, which I think are super important to understand.
Now, you're a big promoter of government as a platform. Government 2.0, as you've sometimes called it.
Yeah.
And part of that is algorithm-based regulation. We have a special term for that in fintech. We call it regtech. I don't know if you've heard that before.
No, but, I haven't, but yeah.
So what do you think in terms of, regtech and applying algorithms to regulation of government and financial services, where do you see that going over the next 15, 20 years?
Well, there are really two answers to that question of where could it go, where should it go, and then where will it go?
Right.
And those two things are very, very different. I think conceptually, if you look at regulatory systems in the private sector, as I think I said in that original piece that I wrote about this, Google search quality is a regulatory system. Credit card fraud detection is a regulatory system. Anti-spam, is a regulatory system.
Mm.
And why isn't the government, and all of these regulatory systems focus on outcomes rather than rules. I mean, nobody actually knows what Google's rules are for search quality.
Right.
Google, and I think everybody else knows what the desired outcome is, right? And managing the outcomes is something that Silicon Valley has gotten very good at and that government still hasn't figured out. I mean, you put in place some set of rules and maybe you do some analysis 5 years later and you discover it's not quite working how you thought and, it's just broken. And of course, when things are broken, that again is when people route around them. And so it's another vector where disruption is happening. Now, could government start to catch up there, start to be doing more sort of algorithmic, real-time regulation in the same way that commercial actors are? Absolutely. Will they? It may take a while. But in the meantime, if they don't, that means that there's this sort of, spy, counter spy, or, measure, countermeasure kind of thing that starts to happen in the private sector to deal with that. And I think it's a very, very interesting question because it starts to show where regulation actually bleeds into cyber warfare in an odd way. If you think about once you have all these algorithmic actors and, where are the boundaries between, somebody who is a bad actor in the financial space and someone who is a bad actor in the security space. They're using a lot of the same tools. And so, in cybersecurity, we're realizing, we need these electronic countermeasures. And as you start to blur the boundary between, the financial system and just in general internet security, I think you're going to actually see government going, this is just how things work today. And they're going to have to catch up.
You talk about the internet operating system sometimes. Do you think that when it comes to cybersecurity, it is a little bit like that, you know, the immune system response, that as more and more attacks take place, the stronger the system gets?
Well, you know, I think it's very like an immune system. You know, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, but sometimes things kill you.
Yeah.
And so I think there will be cases where the system as a whole will get stronger, but I have to say, so far, there's sort of, we still have a lot of real weaknesses where the systems have not gotten more robust.
And it's still, humans are probably the weakest link in this. There's a lot of social engineering and stuff goes on. Listen, I want to, before we finish up the interview, we've got about 4 minutes left, Tim. I do want to talk to you about the impact of algorithms and AI. We talked about self-driving cars, autonomous vehicles. We talked about robo-advisors briefly. You know, there's going to be a lot of job losses to AI, you know, particularly in the services space, accountants, bank tellers, taxi drivers. Where do you see the possibilities for new careers working that may replace the jobs lost by AI?
It's a really interesting question. First of all, I don't entirely buy that argument. There's even been an analysis of, for example, the ATM actually increasing the number of bank tellers because the costs went down so you could have more small branches in more locations. I haven't dug into that. But you certainly see it with something like Uber, where there are more people providing that service than there were before because basically, the technology allowed you to augment workers so that lower-skilled workers could do the job where you could actually increase demand by bringing down the cost and increasing the convenience. And I think we actually will see a lot of that with technology and companies that...
So augmented workers.
Yeah. ...will figure out how to upskill workers. But the challenge, I think there is a challenge, and that is we have to make sure that these jobs pay enough because... Otherwise, you get into this trap of this people aren't paid enough to actually consume the services that are for sale, and the aggregate demand falls off. You know, I mean, the average Starbucks barista can't afford to drink coffee at Starbucks, unless they kind of, I suppose, get it on the side. You know, that's a problem for the economy as a whole, and we do need to address that. But I also think that, you know, technology morphs what we see as a job. Hal Varian, who's the chief economist at Google, likes to say, my grandfather wouldn't recognize what I do as work.
Yep.
And I think that there will be a lot of things in the future that we won't think of as work. I mean, think about even today, you know, social media consultant. What was that? You know, it didn't exist 10 years ago. You know, and, you know, we'll spend more time entertaining each other. We'll spend more, you know, we have to figure out how to monetize these things, and that will be the breakthrough. You know, it's often, you know, it's not just having the job. It's also figuring out how to get paid for the job. You know, for example, if you think about entertainment, you know, we know how to pay for movies. We know how to pay for television. But we don't really know how to pay for social media, even though social media is, in fact, you know, displacing a lot of time spent reading or watching movies.
There's not a lot of value.
You know, and the question is, will the economics of you know, social media and internet time catch up with these other media areas? And then how will that money be distributed to the people who are actually creating the content that's being consumed? And I think that right now, I don't think the platforms are thinking inclusively enough. And it may well be that we end up needing to have the equivalent of a union. You know, I mean, think about movies. United Artists was started by a bunch of actors who said, well, we're not getting paid enough, you know, actors and directors, you know, by this new thing. So we're going to have our own, you know. And I think there's a lot yet to be played out on the labor side of people saying, yeah, there is money being made from these new platforms, but we're not getting it.
Somewhere I saw notice yesterday on the news feed that Uber was unionizing, or part of Uber was unionizing. So listen, Tim, we're gonna run out of time here, unfortunately. But just before we go, 2016. Any predictions? What's going to be big in 2016?
Boy, what's going to be big in 2016? I think, you know, I have to say, not just from tech. Well, let me start with tech. I think, first of all, everything's on a long arc, but I think we're going to see a lot more people waking up to energy and green tech, just because I think climate change is finally reaching a tipping point where people are going, oh, wait, maybe there is something to this. I think there's a huge amount of absolutely transformative stuff happening in biotech.
Oh, yeah, health tech,
In terms of sort of applied AI, I really do think we are starting to see, kind of breakthrough technologies that are allowing companies to really rethink the way you do things.
We're just seeing the start of that, right?
Yeah, we're just seeing the start of that. I mean, machine learning and sensors and everything all coming together in the real world, restructuring industries. If you look at the Uber story, it's got so many elements. It's sort of upskilling of workers, so it's not, is the Uber dispatcher an AI? No, not really. But is it sort of a whole bunch of very complex algorithms replacing, kind of a stupid human and making it possible to deliver a very, very different kind of service? Absolutely. Sensors enabling us to rethink the workflow of this thing. Now you go, okay, well, what happens when that hits healthcare? How would we restructure that whole industry? Like if you look at something like IBM Watson, it's like, well, let's treat Watson like it's a new, CAT scanner, and we'll just sort of sell it into the existing system versus like, wow, a truly disruptive startup that restructures the industry. And I think, coming back to fintech, we are in fact starting to see innovations that really get people to just act differently, think differently, use money differently, bring new players into the space, able to either lend or consume or take payments more easily, or for that matter, even if they're using, the banking back end to really be the consumer face of banking.
Yeah, changing the way it fits
in. Amazon and Apple are where I spend how I spend my money.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. And that's a good point for us to finish on, Tim. For those of you listening in, don't forget the next Money Conference coming up March 14, 15 in San Francisco. It's an O'Reilly Summit. You can check it out on conferences.o'reilly.com. And Tim O'Reilly and Ben Lorica, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks today.
All right. Thank you. Thanks a lot for having us.
Okay, let's go to a quick break. And after the break, Robert Turcek up court talking about his new book, Vaporized. This is Brett King, the host of Breaking Banks. We've got some exciting news for you. We've just joined with Radio Everyone and the United Nations on their Global Goals Initiative. Now, this is a 15-year plan to address 17 specific goals to end poverty, fight inequality, and fix climate change. So, Breaking Banks, we're planning a special episode on October the 1st to talk about the organizations around the world that are using fintech to increase financial inclusion, to eradicate poverty and reduce inequality. Join us at Breaking Banks and the team at Radio Everyone on the UN Global Goals Initiative to end poverty, fight inequality, and fix climate change.
Today, make that long overdue call to your bank and thank them. Thank them for a checking account, one that has a minimum balance and penalties for going below it. Thank them for a savings account, one that has almost no interest and charges statement fees to let you know it. Most of all, thank them for overdraft fees and all those other fees you never even knew existed. Thank them today. Why? Because the future of banking is here, and it's not just what you want, it's what you deserve. Move In is a free app and debit card with no overdraft, ATM, or monthly fees. Best of all, you get an instant receipt every time you make a purchase and daily feedback on your spending so you can always be on top of your money. So make that call to your bank and say thanks, but no thanks. And when you're done, download the free app and get Move In today.
From From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
If you're just joining us, you just missed a great interview with Tim O'Reilly talking earlier. You can follow the conversation with our hashtag Breaking Banks on Twitter. But up now, one of my favorite guests to the show, actually, I think it's his third or fourth time on the show, Robert Turchek, who's just brought out a book. Actually, it's a couple of months ago now, called Vaporize. Robert, welcome back to Breaking Banks.
Hi, Brad. I'm happy to be back.
So tell us about your new book, Vaporized, and how it's going.
It's going great. So the book was written over the process of the past year and a half, but it really got into a tight tempo in last spring, so I'm very happy to have it out. It's called Vaporized, and it's about dematerialization, the replacing of physical stuff with information, with software. It seems like a crazy idea, but we do it every day, you know, with our smartphones. Every time you click something on your smartphone, an app, you're interacting with software that used to be in the form of a physical product. It used to be something that you purchased at a store. Now we just download stuff to our phones. And, of course, that's increasing. It's starting to penetrate every industry. You know, there's chatter in the previous session, with your previous guest about Uber. Uber is one of the best examples. It's the obvious example. Instead of buying a car, you now have access to transportation on demand. You download an app, you touch an icon, and you can get transportation whenever you need it. So why deal with a physical car? Why own it? Why repair it?
So I'll tell you, I want to tell you a personal story about this. My daughter, who's 15, I was saying to her, look, you know, you're 15 now. You can drive next year. We're going to have to start getting serious about teaching you to drive. And she said, Dad, I don't want a driver's license. I'm never going to own a car. Look, save the money. Just give me an Uber account, she said.
See, that's exactly right. And so, yeah, some people, though, are dumbfounded by this process. So part of the idea of writing the book was to get my ideas that I've been speaking about and working with my clients on for the past 6 or 7 years. I was trying to get it into a form where we could hand it out to people. Funny enough, the one way to do that is with a physical book. It's still a very easy way to give people information in a compact, accessible form. And the reaction to the book has been twofold, or sort of split. One group of people sees it, they embrace it, they're enthusiastic about it because they see infinite possibilities. One of my models is everything that can be connected will be, everything that can be vaporized will be, everything that can be turned into software will be. That sounds like big opportunity. But then again, there's another group of people who react against it. It's a completely oppositional response.
Yeah, I don't get that. I mean,
look, I'm happy they exist because it means I have a chance for some dialogue, exchange, and of course, they're all customers eventually because then they wake up eventually, as your banking clients do.
I know.
They start to see it, right? You've been talking about vaporizing the bank for 10 years. Yeah. You've been talking about vaporizing branches for 10 years, and now finally this year we're starting to see the data come back that shows that you were absolutely on the right track.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I read that post about the credit card. I've been mystified by this, right? What is a credit card? It's a little piece of plastic. It's this little like manifestation of trust in the form of a plastic thing. And then your signature is required still. I'm up in Canada this week. And the Canadians look at us as like slightly retarded because in the United States, we still use our signature for a credit card transaction. And they look at you and they say, really, you have a smart card with a chip in it and you still have
to sign.
You're
still using a first century artifact.
Exactly. And then, of course, what does that signature really, really represent to us? You know, why do we trust that little scrawl on a piece of paper?
It's not secure. It's not, you know, you can duplicate it easily, relatively easily. You can't verify it well. It doesn't make
sense. Does it? So there's a ton of resistance out there, and I see it as an opportunity, you know, occasion to jump on my soapbox and preach and explain and convince and persuade. Sometimes that works. But there is a group of people in just about every industry I've talked to and dealt with where they're basically walling out this process. They refuse to see it. They refuse to acknowledge it. And they're really just clinging on to their jobs until they retire. There's a concept of in physics of generational replacement where, you know, certain ideas are so radical that you have to wait for the current generation of physicists to die off before the next generation can kind of, you know, work on those ideas and research them and publish them. Something similar is afoot in highly entrenched businesses. And the more tightly
ending, ending government.
Well, that's what I was about to say, because the last conversation you had with O'Reilly was about regulation. He touched on that topic, and the two are intertwined. So heavily regulated businesses, like the automotive industry, the airline industry, the banking industry, these businesses are very slow to change because that government, you know, those government regulations have kind of shaped the entire industry, or probably I should say the industry shapes itself to conform to regulation. They optimize right. for the regulation. Those regulations then become kind of a barrier to entry for new companies. And actually, you could probably split the whole financial business into two buckets. One bucket that's lightly regulated, where you're going to see a tremendous amount of change, and then another bucket where it's highly regulated. It's going to be very slow to change. And probably those businesses will be with us for a long time.
Yeah, and you know, the signature is a good example of that, right? Because in 2001, with the e-cig, you know, rules that came out regarding, you know, the internet, we actually at that point allowed banks to open an account without a physical signature. That was 2001. Mm-hmm. But 90% of banks in the US still require a signature card for account opening. It's not a regulatory requirement, it's just inertia in the system.
It's not just inertia. I'm going to steal your idea. I'm going to steal one of your ideas here. It's a way to oblige you to come into the store. Oblige you to come. You have to validate the fact that, like, the entire power structure inside of a bank is branch management. And the more branches you have, the more branches you manage, the more powerful you are in that organization. So they have to force their customers to come in. This is one of the principal reasons why we're going to vaporize things. We're going to replace things with software. It's about productivity.
Yeah.
You know, there's been this debate in our entire economy in the last few years about wage stagnation, income inequality. These are different flavors of the same idea. And at the core is a topic that's often overlooked. When people talk about inequality and wages, they forget that the only way you can really increase wages is to increase productivity. And productivity growth has been stalling, particularly in services. So I'm sure, for instance, the productivity growth of bankers and the tellers has been very low. It's certainly the case with government. You know, about a third of what government does is physically handling paper, filing paper, retrieving paper, tracking paper, storing paper, generating new paper. This is incredibly inefficient. And so these are places where we've had low or no productivity growth. Well, you can't raise wages without productivity growth, because if you do, that's inflationary. It actually makes right. everybody poorer. And so the only way to really raise wages is to generate more productivity, and then that increases the pool of wealth whereby you can raise wages for people and pay them more. Well, the ways to raise productivity all sound really bad. And in an election year, 2016, you're not going to hear anyone talk about this, but destroying jobs is important. It's actually it's an absolutely vital prerequisite to increasing productivity.
Right, and historically, it's happened over and over again. I mean, you know, when O'Reilly was talking about low-skilled workers being augmented by technology, I was thinking about the Luddites, the textile workers being yeah. displaced by, you know, child laborers on steam machines, right?
It keeps coming up as a topic, and it won't go away, but you'll probably hear more politicians talk about saving jobs, bringing back the high-paid manufacturing jobs. This is fiction. This is fantasy.
Exactly.
Those jobs are never coming back. We will re-onshore manufacturing, but we're going to do it with robotics.
Robotics, so you
have a small number of workers who are well-paid managing a factory of robots. This is already happening. This is not science fiction.
It's a productivity gain, though.
Precisely. Other forms of productivity gain where we can actually help generate higher wages, ultimately, to reduce friction in the system. That means paperwork, shuffling paperwork, things like going to a bank to sign a piece of paper. Why? Because it supports the branch manager's career path. It has nothing to do with reducing the friction in the transaction for the consumer. Yeah. An unnecessary process, the unnecessary packaging of products with extra stuff, you know, all that packaging, the shrink wrap, the bubble wrap, the blister packs, the blister seals that are on top of our the products that we buy. The more we shift to digital, the less of that crap we have to make, the less the landfill will generate. And, of course, regulations. So I think this is a very good season for us to revisit regulations. The U.S. government has 40,000 laws, 40,000 statutes, 40,000 laws, but they create so many other regulatory bodies. And those regulatory bodies indeed create rules. So there are probably hundreds of thousands of rules that businesses have to follow. I would love to hear one politician come forth in this election cycle and say, my first step will be to eliminate unnecessary laws. We're going to do a survey of all the federal statutes and get rid of the ones we no longer need.
Yeah, you know, those from 1823 that say you can't wear a red scarf in front of a horse or something, So I've got a question for you. When do you think, you know, because this year we're spending, what, $5 billion on the presidential election. When are we going to vaporize elections?
Well, I'll tell you, it's entirely possible. So we know this because in Estonia now, every citizen in Estonia has a personal identity card issued by the government that is also... you use it for public transport. You could use it for payments. It's got military
grade. And you and I can sign up for that too.
That's exactly right. So they've vaporized national identity. You can actually become a citizen of Estonia if you want, a virtual citizen. And with that card, you can also vote. You can vote on your phone. It makes a ton of sense, right? The whole issue with voting.
Bring your own device to voting, absolutely.
Yeah, the whole issue with voting in person is to verify an identity. But if you think about the way that really plays out in the United States, it means... you walk into a school or a gymnasium or something, and there's a bunch of nice volunteers there, and they check your name off a list. That's not really a very great verification of identity. In Estonia, you can simply verify your identity using your government card, the secure card, and you can do the voting on your phone. This makes an enormous amount of sense. We should have adopted this. It's very strange. The United States doesn't tend to be at the leading edge. We always like to think we are. But in a lot of ways, we don't, and it's where it supports an existing power structure, where it supports an entrenched business interest. They have no reason to change until... what I loved about what Tim said a minute ago...
So, Robert, we are running out of time, and I don't want to lose the opportunity. We've got about a minute left. But what I want to do is make sure people know where they can get your book. Where can people get vaporized?
Easiest way to get it is on Amazon, or order it from your local bookshop if you want to support your local retailer. I love that idea. On Amazon, you can also get the Kindle edition. But, you know, Brett, if people don't want to buy a book, if they're overloaded with physical books, just check it out on the web at vaporizedbook.com. It's one
fantastic
word.
Fantastic.
The whole manuscript is up there.
And have you got some of your speeches up there, your recent
talk? Oh, yeah, those are up on Vimeo. I have a page on Vimeo with a bunch of videos.
Okay, so we'll make sure we tweet that out through the Breaking Banks Twitter handle as well so that people can check out some of your talks. And be great to catch up face-to-face again sometime soon.
Thank you. Have a wonderful holiday season.
Thank you, Robert. That was Robert Turchek, the author of the new book, Vaporized. We had Tim O'Reilly on earlier. It was a fantastic show. Coming out in a couple of weeks, our end-of-year show, it will have Ken from the CEO of Credit Karma. We've got a great couple of shows lined up to you to finish out the year. David Bach is going to be on that show as well. But thanks again for listening, guys. Thanks for another great show. Robert, thanks for joining us. And we'll be back with Breaking Banks next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time for more of the latest in fintech news.